So as I think I mentioned the other week, we're going to take a break from Exodus at the end of chapter 19, which means that this morning's session is our last for the time being in this book. And it's Exodus 19, then verses 9 to 25, that we're particularly looking at. Now throughout chapters 3 to 12 of this book, a particular Hebrew word is used many times. It's used to describe what Israel was going to do following the Exodus. And this Hebrew word, you can give it quite a broad translation, serve. So following the Exodus, Israel was going to serve Yahweh, in which case the focus is on the new way of life Israel was going to have, living now under Yahweh's lordship. Alternatively, you can give this word a much narrower translation, worship. So following the Exodus, Israel was going to worship Yahweh, in which case the focus is on a specific event when Israel was going to come before her God. Now, the ESV, it goes for serve every time. Every time this Hebrew word occurs in chapters 3 to 12, the ESV translates it serve. The NIV, on the other hand, it goes for worship every time the word occurs. So which is right? Well, I don't think either is, actually. I don't think the word should be translated the same way every time it occurs in those chapters. Rather, in some of its occurrences, one of the meanings is more to the fore, and in some of its occurrences, the other of the two meanings is more to the fore. So often, what's in view is this new way of life Israel was going to enter into, and serve is the right term. Israel was going to serve Yahweh. Long term, following the Exodus. But that isn't always what's in view. Sometimes it's a specific event. Two quick examples of verses chapter 3, verse 12. Yahweh speaking to Moses at the burning bush. I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall, this Hebrew word, God, on this mountain. Now clearly that's talking about a specific event on this mountain. An act of worship, not a lifestyle of service. And then secondly, chapter 10, verse 26, Moses explaining to Pharaoh that when they leave, they can't go without their livestock, as the king is insisting they must go without their livestock. No, our livestock, Moses says, must go with us. Not a hoof shall be left behind, for we must take of them to this Hebrew word, the Lord our God, and we do not know with what we must, this Hebrew word, the Lord, until we arrive there. Again, the focus is unmistakably there on an act of worship, a specific, one-off act of worship, rather than on a general lifestyle of service. So I want you to understand then that among the different goals which the Exodus had, some of them longer term, some of them shorter term, among the different goals which the Exodus had, this is one. Israel was leaving Egypt headed for an act of worship. Right from the burning bush, this engagement had been, as it were, written in Israel's diary. She would walk free from her slavery, and shortly thereafter, there would be this event, this occasion, this coming of the newly redeemed people before her God. And I'm laboring this point because here in our passage this morning, this is it. This is it. This is the act of worship. This is what chapter 3 verse 12 and chapter 10 verse 26 had anticipated. Here in these verses, that engagement for so long written in Israel's diary, it finally transpires. Now, earlier in our service this morning, we read from Hebrews chapter 12. The writer to the Hebrews, you'll know again, and again, in his book, takes an Old Testament text and bases his remarks on that Old Testament text. And there in the second half of Hebrews 12, his Old Testament text is this one that we're looking at this morning. And he concludes his remarks on that text with these words, Hebrews 12, 28, let us offer to God acceptable worship. Now that shows he understood Exodus 19 the way I've just explained it. He saw it as an act of worship. But it also shows that he wasn't interested in this act of worship merely as a piece of ancient history. Rather, he was interested in how it relates to our New Testament Christian worship. And our approach to Exodus 19 this morning will be very much influenced by Hebrews 12. It's always good when a New Testament writer has done the work for you as a preacher. So let's focus particularly then on three things. First of all, the meeting. The meeting. And I think we'll spend longest on this morning. The meeting. Now, the writer to the Hebrews makes it abundantly clear. Exodus 19 is not a manual for Christian worship. Much of what he says there in Hebrews 12 takes the form of contrast. This is Israel's worship at Sinai. This, on the other hand, is our worship. And we'll come to that, and we'll seek to do justice to that contrast. However, it would be wrong to think that Exodus 19 is an entirely foreign country. That when applied to this passage, the word worship has an altogether different meaning from that which it now has. And there's no continuity, and there are no points of contact. That would be a mistaken conclusion, because at the end of the day, when you boil it down to its very core, what is this worship in Exodus 19? What is it? Well, the key statement is in verse 17. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God. That's what it is. It's a meeting with God. And that core hasn't changed. Worship is still a meeting with God. Our worship is a meeting with God. And I want us to pause and let that sink in. Our worship is a meeting with God. It's not a few hymns, prayers, and Bible readings. It's not a sequence of familiar items climaxing with a sermon. It's way, way more than that. It is a meeting with God. And millennia may have passed since Exodus 19. And there may have been that seismic change from Old Testament to New Testament, but a meeting with God is a meeting with God. There's something irreducible about it. No matter that the date is 2021 AD rather than 1500 BC, a meeting with God cannot but have a spine-tingling gravity about it. That's why Hebrews 12 pretty much ends with those famous three words. Reverence and awe. Reverence and awe. Let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe. But dear writer, you feel like protesting. Don't those three words undermine what you've been saying? You've been distinguishing New Testament worship so starkly from what took place at Sinai. You've been saying it's so different. How then can a Christian meeting with God require reverence and awe? To which I think he would reply, dear reader, the answer to your question is in the question. Precisely because it's a Christian meeting with God, it requires reverence and awe. For God, regardless of the epoch and regardless of the setting, cannot be met in any other way. Now, I don't think you have to be a grumpy old man to acknowledge that much evangelical Christianity fails to reckon with this truth that we're talking about. This simple truth that worship is a meeting with God, and a meeting with God is an intrinsically weighty and unnerving business. Listen to Don Carson. He comments, the Jews of Jesus' day were inclined on the whole to conceive of God as so exalted that personal relationships with him could scarcely be imagined. He was so transcendent that the richness of personality was frequently lost to view. But then Carson continues, by contrast, much modern evangelicalism tends to portray him as exclusively personal and warm. Somehow his sovereignty and exalted transcendence disappear. If you enter certain American churches, you will hear the enthusiastic singing of some such ditty as, "He's a great big wonderful God." Regrettably, I never fail to think of a great big wonderful teddy bear. Such choruses are not quite heretical, not quite blasphemous. I sometimes wish they were, for then they could be readily condemned for specific evil. They are something much worse than isolated blasphemy and heresy. They constitute part of a pattern of irreverence, shallow theology, and experience-dominated religious criteria, which has eviscerated a terribly high proportion of evangelical strength in the Western world. But you know, that low view of meeting with God, which causes churches to introduce idiotic ditties, it can exist in churches which don't introduce idiotic ditties. It can exist in churches like ours. It can exist in the hearts of men and women who may sing the grandest, loftiest Christian lyrics. And so we must ask ourselves then, do we see worship? Do we see what we are doing on a Sunday? Do we see it in these terms? Do we see it as a meeting with God? And you might say, well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether genuinely I see worship in those terms. Well, the passage gives us two tests. It suggests that those who are properly viewing worship as a meeting with God will take seriously two things. First of all, a connection. A connection. Notice that in verse 10, these Israelite worshippers are to wash their garments. They're to wash their garments. Why? Is God really that concerned about clean clothing? Is he scrutinizing your attire this morning to make sure there are no marks and stains on it? Well, no, the point is, this purification of garments here, it symbolizes and pictures something else, namely moral purification. You see, there's a particular problem that constantly resurfaces throughout the Old Testament, and it's this: the separation by God's people of worship from lifestyle. Again and again, we see the Israelites leading horribly immoral lives, and yet at the same time being energetic and unstinting in their worship of God. And because of all that worship that's going on, under the impression that everything is hunky-dory. It's this recurring problem then, and the need to address it, which produces some iconic texts in the Old Testament. To obey is better than sacrifice, 1 Samuel 15:22. I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings, Hosea 6, verse 6. Those texts, you see, they are seeking to reverse this separation and highlight the profound connection between worship and lifestyle. And that connection between worship and lifestyle has been hinted at here then. These worshippers at Sinai washing their clothes as a picture of washing themselves morally. And this connection remains important. Let me put it this way. The worship of God is hopelessly insincere when worshippers are not dealing with everything in their lives which displeases the God they worship. Let me say that again. The worship of God is hopelessly insincere when worshippers are not dealing with everything in their lives which displeases the God whom they worship. It's why in that passage we touched on a few weeks ago in our series on reconciliation, Matthew 5, 23 and 24, Jesus tells the worshipper who has wronged a brother to defer worship, to delay it, to put it off, to go and be reconciled to the other person first, because otherwise, you see, the worship will be a farce. On the one hand, that person in the act of worship will be saying, God, you're of supreme importance to me and I'm utterly devoted to you. And yet on the other hand, that person will be saying, I can't be bothered to deal with that wrong I've done to a brother, even though you detest that kind of behavior, God. You see the glaring contradiction there. I wonder, are our fine sentiments in worship backed up by lives in which we are concerned for God's pleasure and honour. Lives in which, not perfectly, and not, as we said last Sunday evening, with unfailing success, but sincerely, sincerely, we are fighting that which God hates. If we're taking seriously the connection between worship and lifestyle, that indicates we really do see worship in terms of a meeting with God. And then the other thing, as well as a connection, a priority. A priority. Notice that in verse 15, these worshippers are to practice sexual abstinence. Is that because the Bible is generally disapproving of sexual relations? Not at all. Not if they're in the proper context of lifelong marriage between one man and one woman. Anyone who has read the Song of Solomon, the early chapters of Proverbs, knows that there's no disapproval whatsoever, quite the opposite. No, the point here is that the worship of God takes priority over other things. Even the best things, even the most beautiful and sublime things, even the best gifts that God has given us. Worship doesn't fit around everything else. I mean, that's the modern way of thinking, isn't it? Yes, all things being equal, on a Sunday morning I worship God. That's what I like to do. And as long as there's no big sporting fixture on, and as long as there's no kid's birthday party on, that's what I do. And you see what's going on there? Worship is fitting around everything else. But no, everything else fits around and is disrupted by the worship of God. That's the point of this abstinence here. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not propounding here some kind of sacred secular divide. I know that the whole of life can be and should be lived in a spirit of worshipping God. We were talking about that at Time Out on Tuesday evening. But worshipping God in all our daily activities does not supplant, does not take the place of this more focused and intense meeting with God. And it comes first. And indeed, worshipping God in the activities of daily life really flows out of that. That is to say, meeting with God this way on the Lord's Day will animate you more than anything else to live for his glory and honor Monday to Saturday. So I'm saying, let's reflect much on our Christian worship as a meeting with God. And it'll indicate that we are reflecting much on that when we take seriously this connection between worship and lifestyle and this priority, everything else fitting around worship. And so that's the first thing, and as I say, the longest thing this morning, the meeting. But notice with me, secondly, the mountain. The mountain. So the site of this worship in Exodus 19 is, of course, a mountain. And what a mountain. Look at verse 16. On the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and a very loud trumpet blast, that all the people in the camp trembled. Verse 18. Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. Now, to be sure, a mountain like that would have been more than a little frightening, but it would also have been impressive, wouldn't it? So that there's perhaps something in us somewhere that's ever so slightly envious of the Israelites in Exodus 19. I mean, we love our little building here, don't we? And we're very grateful for it, but it doesn't give us goosebumps when we turn up on a Sunday morning. Imagine if instead of this edifice, there was on this site a mountain. And every Sunday, that mountain became the focal point of all these crazy phenomena. Thunder and lightning, thick cloud, a trumpet blast getting louder and louder and louder, and all the rest of it. I mean, that would be quite something, wouldn't it? And throughout Benton and Long Benton and Heaton and Forest Hall and South Gosforth and throughout most of Newcastle, indeed, everyone would stop what they're doing and look nervously out of their windows and say, oh yes, NREC's worship must be about to begin. Perhaps, as I say, secretly, we wish that our Sunday mornings did look a little bit more like Exodus 19. That seems to be how the first readers of the book of Hebrews felt. Probably they met in someone's living room on the Lord's Day. And it all just seemed to lack the wow factor. It was banal and unspectacular. That's probably one of the reasons that some of them were just giving up on the whole thing. And the writer has to say, famously in chapter 10, do not neglect the meetings of God's people. Now, when Christian worship seems banal and unspectacular, when it seems to compare very unfavorably with the noise and drama of coming to this mountain in Exodus 19, there's a way of addressing that, a very popular way of addressing it. We can just make our worship services more noisy and dramatic. We can turn them into rock concerts with strobe lighting and deafening music. Or indeed, we can turn them into magnificently slick productions. Don Carson, again, talks about one form of this that he particularly detests. He writes, in many of our churches, prayers in morning services now function in large measure as the time to change the set in the sanctuary. The people of the congregation bow their heads and close their eyes, and when they look up a minute later, why, the singers are in place, or the drama group is ready to perform. It's also smooth. It's also profane. Nominally, we're in prayer together, addressing the King of Heaven, the Sovereign Lord. In reality, some of us are doing that, while others are rushing on tiptoes around the stage. And others, with their eyes closed, are busy wondering what new and happy configuration will confront them when it is time to take a peek. Has the smoothness of the performance become more important to us than the fear of the Lord? But that's one way of addressing this whole thing, then. One way of addressing the banality and the unspectacular nature of Christian worship. That's not the writer to the Hebrews way of addressing it. This is his way. He says, look, you guys in that living room, you need to understand what is really going on when you meet for worship in that place on the Lord's Day. There's way more going on than meets the eye. In fact, he says in verse 22, you have come to a mountain. You have come to a mountain. You can imagine those first readers looking blank at that. No, no. Number 47 on the high street, a semi-detached, three-bedroom house, small garden. That's where we are on a Sunday. That's where we worship. But no, the writer says, you have come to a mountain. And in fact, he says, such a mountain as makes Sinai with its thunder and lightning and its thick cloud and its trumpet blast seem tame by comparison. You have come to Mount Zion, he says. That's heaven. That's what he means. Where the angels are and where the departed saints are and where God is and where Jesus is. That's what's happening. Every Sunday morning, the writer to the Hebrews says, you are coming in reality, yes, outwardly to a living room and it's all very banal and unspectacular, but in reality you are coming to heaven itself. And the same is true of us in our Christian worship. When I was a teenager, I did the Coast to Coast walk with Andy Day, whom some of you know. He was here for the anniversary the other week, and we were in the Lake District early on in that walk across the country, and we were in the mountains, and the mist came down while we were there, and we got completely lost, and we ended up following this path, and the path seemed fine and unremarkable enough, and in the end, it brought us somewhere. It brought us to a lake which we subsequently discovered was Wastwater, and there was a campsite there, and so we just stayed there and camped the night. The next morning we woke up and the mist had lifted altogether, and we could see the path that we had come down, and it was along the edge of a precipice, and it was very sheer and it was very dramatic, and there were these huge drops on either side. And we had been then in that very dramatic situation without even realizing it. And that's often the case, probably, when you and I are driving home from here on a Sunday morning. We've been in a very dramatic situation without even realizing it, perhaps. We've been on Mount Zion with its sheer precipices. We've been in heaven already to some extent, in some sense, with the angels, with the departed saints, with the triune God himself. Michael Horton is an American Reformed theologian. And he writes this interestingly. He writes, "I am persuaded that one of the reasons why so many churches have gone to drama and other theatrical arts in worship is because the sermon and the larger liturgical setting have failed to provide the sense that something important and dramatic is happening here, now, as we gather before God." Sometimes we need to pray, don't we? A bit like what Elisha prayed for his servant. When the servant was panicking about the armies that had come to capture his master, and that's all he could see, and he could see nothing else apart from that, and Elisha prayed for his eyes to be opened, and then he saw a whole different scene. And he saw all those armies of angels. And as we come here on a Sunday morning, we need to pray, "Lord, open our eyes to where we really are, to what's really going on, to the drama that we don't need to engineer through lots of song and dance, but the drama that is built into the whole thing that we're doing, the intrinsic, inherent drama, the drama of coming to Mount Zion and joining with heaven in our worship." Let's not be deceived by the ordinariness of the building and the chairs and the faces of the people we sit next to week after week. But let's realize what is really going on. And the mountain that we are coming to in Lord's Day worship. The meeting, the mountain. Thirdly and finally this morning, the mediator. The mediator. I saw a video recently, and it was an interview with Emma Raducanu, the tennis player who has had this meteoric rise this year. But in this video, she was 11 years old, and she was being interviewed at some junior tennis competition. And the interviewer then complimented her on the level of tennis that she'd been playing in this competition, and asked whether she wanted to become a professional tennis player one day, and she said yes she did. And then the interviewer asked whether she thought that one day she could win a Grand Slam, and she said, well, she hoped that perhaps she could one day win a Grand Slam. And looking back, although she was only a child and she was playing in some very unglamorous, low-key setting on that day, you can see in that video the trajectory that she is on. You can see the hunger and the ability and the determination. You could see this trajectory she's on that would culminate 7 years later in her indeed winning a Grand Slam. And it's a little bit like that here in Exodus 19. You know, here in Exodus 19, there's something that's actually so glaring that we can miss it. Things can be so glaring, can't they, that you can actually miss them altogether. And I think there's something here that's so glaring we can actually miss it. And we can be so busy giving this scene a bad press because of the contrast between Sinai worship and our worship. And we can be so busy giving this passage a bad press that we can miss this. God here wants his people to be able to safely worship him. God wants his people to be able to safely worship him. He doesn't want them to be destroyed in approaching his holy majesty. More than that, he ensures through a mediator that they won't be destroyed. Someone who is a kind of go-between in this divine-human meeting. Moses, of course, is whom I'm talking about. And in all kinds of ways then, this mediator, he ensures that this worship can proceed safely. And so in verse 12, he sets limits. Perhaps physical limits, perhaps some kind of ancient equivalent of a tape, a cordon, cones, I don't know, something. That was a visible, physical limit. so that the people would not go too far. I think it's implied in verse 17, the verse I mentioned at the start, that when Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, precisely because Moses was the man who would know when to say stop. You can't go any further. He was a guide, a safe guide, who wouldn't let them step a millimetre too far. Now then in verse 21, of course, he's to warn the people. So there's verbal warnings. That's another tool that he uses, this mediator, in ensuring this worship can proceed safely. In fact, he's told to warn the people to the point that he feels it's a bit excessive, doesn't he? He kind of protests in verse 23. I don't need to warn them again. You've already told us. You've already told me to set limits. I put a cord in there. That's clear enough. I don't need to warn them again, surely, Lord. But this is his role as mediator, to really, really, really make sure that the wrath of God does not break out. There's this trumpet blast in verse 13. I think that's a different trumpet blast. It's a different Hebrew word, actually, a different trumpet blast from the one that's mentioned in verse 16 and verse 19. The point of the one in verse 13 is after the event, this trumpet blast will take place, as one commentator puts it, sounding the all clear after the Lord has left the mountain and it has become safe to venture up it again. And so you can see then that there's this great desire in the heart of God that he shouldn't, in that phrase he uses a couple of times, he shouldn't break out against them. Verse 22, verse 24, he doesn't want to break out against them. And so through this mediator, putting in place all these different measures, God ensures that. And as with the video then, the tennis video, looking back now from a later vantage point, we can see that God here is on a trajectory that would culminate in another mediator. Not Moses, but Jesus, who would ensure that God's people can worship God safely. But he would do it not through cordons and cones and tape and verbal warnings and trumpet blasts, it's okay now. No, he would do it by means of absorbing the wrath of God in his own person. Not holding it back through a whole range of measures, but absorbing it, bringing it onto himself and exhausting it and taking the whole of it so that it could not possibly break out against God's people. And this fact then, it gives Christian worship a whole different atmosphere. It means that God's wrath is not this dreadful possibility now hanging over Christian worship. And should we make one little misstep and go an inch and a half too far in one direction, it might come and break out against us. No, that possibility is gone. We don't worship God like hikers going through a jungle at twilight, and there could be some nasty beast that suddenly leaps out of them around any corner. No, worship has a different atmosphere altogether now. The other week we were on a ferry coming back from a Scottish island, and there was a pretty big swell in the sea on this day, and not all members of my family enjoyed that, but Fraser and I enjoyed that very much indeed, and we just kind of stood outside the whole time just watching these huge waves that were coming along and buffeting the ferry. And I felt safe. Why did I feel safe? If I'd been in my kayak in those waves, I wouldn't have felt remotely safe. I'd have been absolutely terrified and probably wouldn't have lasted 2 minutes. But I felt safe. I felt safe because I was on a ferry, this huge vessel that could withstand the waves. And being thus safe, I could enjoy the power and immensity of the waves without being remotely threatened by them. Treated them with respect. And if Fraser had started to walk along the top of the railing like on a tightrope, I'd have got him off there pretty quickly. But not afraid, not feeling threatened. And that's the situation of Christian worship, having Christ as mediator. That now we can enjoy the power and immensity of the God we are worshipping, who hasn't changed. He's still the same God as in Exodus 19. But we can enjoy this power and immensity now, not feeling threatened by it. We treat it with respect, with that reverence and awe we talked about at the start this morning. But we're not threatened. And we can gaze at it and take it in, like Fraser and I did with those waves that day, and be enraptured by the beauty and the wonder and the glory of it all. I mentioned in my series on contentment recently Jeremiah Burroughs. He was a Puritan who wrote probably his most famous book on contentment. He did write another book called Gospel Worship. It has a much longer Puritan title, but Gospel Worship is the title it normally goes by these days. And in this book, he has a lovely sentence. He says that as Christians in our worship, we must come with Christ. And Christ, he says, takes us by the hand. Really, our worship is verse 17, but you replace Moses with Christ, don't you? Christ brings us out every Sunday. At the start of our worship, Christ takes us by the hand and brings us into this worship of God. And because Christ, who has absorbed the breaking out of God's wrath, is the one bringing us into God's presence, we know we're safe. And we can just enjoy the beauty and glory of this God we're worshipping. And this mediator, he's not kind of nervously looking around him. Oh, stop. Don't go any further. No, this mediator says, come further. Come with me. All the way to the throne. Come with me. There's nothing to be paralyzed in fear about. The motto over Christian worship is not the warnings of Exodus 19 anymore. It's James 4 verse 8. Draw near to God. Draw near to God. No condemnation now I dread. Jesus and all in him is mine. Alive in him, my living head, and clothed with righteousness divine. Bold I approach the eternal throne and claim the crown through Christ my own. What a thing to worship God with this mediator, Jesus Christ. Amen. Well, let's close singing 711. Let us love and sing and wonder. Let us praise the Saviour's name. 711.